What is your name?
Warren Farha.
Can you spell that?
That's W-A-R-R-E-N. My last name is F, like Frank, A-R-H-A.
Okay. And what is the name of your bookstore?
Eighth Day Books.
And what is your status in this bookstore?
I'm the founder and owner.
Okay. And where is your bookstore located?
We are at 2838 East Douglas in Wichita, Kansas. We started the store at 3700 East Douglas, 1988.
Okay. So when did your bookstore open? 1988.
September 8th, 1988, okay. To be exact.
Okay. No more general questions. What sets your bookstore apart? What are the defining characteristics of your bookstore?
Well, the store's focus is to concentrate on classics in literature, religion, the arts, philosophy, theology, etc. The key word is classic. We try to focus on those books that have been perennially important, books that have been important for the shaping of human thought, the best that's been thought and written. That's our goal. That's our aspiration.
How do you choose books in your bookstore?
Well, we choose books based on those criteria.
Okay.
The books that we feel have been seminal books or pivotal books in any particular field.
Do you receive like outside suggestions?
Every day.
Every day? Okay. All
right. I have a background in classics and religion, so I have read quite a bit in those fields. I guess that's how the knowledge base started, was what I had learned up to the age of 32 when I started, 33 when I started the store. But every day, customers come in with their own suggestions, and we learn a tremendous amount from our own customers, who represent a pretty savvy group of readers. So we're constantly profiting from that. I was part of a circle of friends that read pretty deeply in religion, theology, so forth. So I learned a tremendous amount from those, from that circle of friends.
And who is the circle of friends? Who are the circle of friends?
Oh, they would include people like Dale Allison, who is a first-rate biblical scholar, and is now the chair of in an endowed chair at Princeton Theological Seminary. Michael Neth, who teaches at Middle Tennessee State University. Chris Kettler, who's professor of theology at Friends University since the late 70s, I believe. Early 80s. And several others. Doug Nye, he was a fellow student at Wichita State University. A number of others, but those were the core people. Bob Harrington, a local resident, but who's a genius in certain fields, mostly science and philosophy. So that kind of hits the high points.
Okay. Very broad. Can you tell us anything about the founding and early days of the bookstore? What motivated you?
Yeah, I wanted to. I'd been part of a family business since I was a child. I worked for my dad growing up, and worked with my family up until I was 33, when due to a personal crisis, the loss of my first wife in an auto accident, I decided to reorient my job, my life vocationally, and so that led me to think of starting a bookstore, basically because I thought that would be a pretty cool job to look forward to going to every day. And it would incorporate what I had learned as far as being in retail all my life, but it would also incorporate my academic interests at Wichita State, which were religion and classical studies. I could put those skills together in starting a bookstore that I thought would do something that nobody else was really doing, and that's really focusing on the classics. And in addition, I wanted to bring Orthodox Christianity, some people would say Eastern Orthodox Christianity, and that term is not to my liking for a number of reasons, but I wanted to bring Orthodoxy to the table of cultural conversation, which I didn't see happening anywhere else. So those are the components that came together when I opened this store.
Okay. What kind of training, education, or experience did you receive prior to running this business? You kind of already answered that.
I did, and strangely enough, my experience in the book business in particular was limited to about 9 months working at a local Christian bookstore back in right after I got out of high school. Apart from that, I had no experience whatsoever in the book business. So I started from scratch as far as that goes, and made all the mistakes that you would expect someone who's so green as I was to make.
Did the bookstore that you worked at, was it there that you found your niche, or you found the niche, or...
No, it was much later.
It was much later.
Much, much later.
Okay.
It was during college years, late college years, and even later.
Well, I mean, you found your niche for the business. Like, you found a business that would provide for the people who are deprived of classics.
The story.
I assume a Christian bookstore... I work at a Christian bookstore, and they have very generic or very, they have a wide range.
Right.
And
well, this is a typical evangelical bookstore, of which there are many, many throughout the country. I did learn a lot about books and authors there in the evangelical world, at least. I did Bible imprinting, and I did deliveries for that store. It was a pretty prominent Christian bookstore, regionally even. Was a leading Christian bookstore in the evangelical book world. So I count it as a blessing that I got to work there. Was so young.
This is the last redundant question. What are other experience books or contacts, so authors or people personally that have influenced your personal choice?
Well, I would say the first really pivotal author in my own life was C.S. Lewis, who I discovered when I was 16 years old, and by a strange set of coincidences picked up Mere Christianity. I knew nothing about Lewis, but that book intrigued me from a footnote I had read in another book. And that's how important footnotes are. And so I went to Lewis and Mere Christianity, and it changed my life. It kind of, in many ways, was formative in my intellectual and emotional life, my understanding of Christian faith and how it related to other arenas of thought and knowledge, English literature, mythology, philosophy, so many other areas were kind of opened the door for me to understand them in a Christian way. So C.S. Lewis, a little bit further down the road, was Alexander Schmemann, who's one of the greatest Orthodox theologians of the 20th century, wrote a great book called For the Life of the World, which changed the face of liturgical studies. I got it. So For the Life of the World kind of returned me to the roots of my own native Orthodox faith. I was born and raised in an Orthodox community, and so well, this may get off topic, but I in my teens encountered the Jesus movement, which was a major kind of groundswell of Christian experience and evangelism that took place in the late 60s and early 70s. Very influential here in Wichita and at my local school. And so I became involved in a large gathering of so-called Jesus people. And it was through that arena that I really began to experience the evangelical sort of frame of Christianity. But a little bit later then, reading Schmemann and Robert Payne and other writers, it sort of helped me return to the patristic roots of Christian faith that you find in Orthodoxy. So my life in faith was kind of a synthesis of those two experiences, I guess you could say.
Does your bookstore do any community service or outreach or any projects with the community? Broadly interpreted. I know you, like, I was part of Pastor Boyle's
reading group.
I know he worked through you. They still order books from you quite often.
Yes.
Things like that.
Well, I guess that is a community service, but it's certainly a sort of self-serving one because I sell books through that activity. I guess you could say school book fairs would be another way in which we participate in the community in a positive way, I hope. I'm trying to stock the best children's books that we can. Again, it's also a commercial enterprise.
Yes. Well, it's your presence in the community. So.
Sure. So, yes. 8th Day Books is the meeting place of several book groups and discussion groups that I think are really valuable and praiseworthy and bring people together in a really a rich community of thought and experience. Some of these groups have been meeting for 10, 15 years on an ongoing basis. So I think that would probably cover it. I feel like an emphasis on the classics is a source of health for the wider community to remind people of their roots, of the roots of our civilization, the roots of our culture. So... Well, we're open. We're open about 60 hours a week. 10 hours a day times five. Yeah, about 60 hours a week. So we're a regular bricks and mortar bookseller. At least half of our revenue is generated through over-the-counter sales to walk-in trade. The other half of the revenue is through off-site events, which we do frequently, going to conferences and conferences, educational, literary, arts conferences, theological conferences. And we also sell quite a bit online and through mail order. People come to us for the classics, for the real essence, the essential writers in particular fields, specialized writers. We try to go beyond the familiar names into those writers who influenced the familiar names. So we try to go back to the roots of those great works that have stood out to those more obscure works that may have nourished, you know, the great well-known books. And so we're kind of known for digging in and finding some obscure sources that are yet very important. C.S. Lewis is fabulously popular, continually popular, even after these 30-plus years. His books sell on a daily basis without even us realizing it until we run out of particular titles. They just quietly get purchased and leave the front door. Children's books have been a very important part of our business from the get-go. More important than I ever thought they would be.
What kind of authors, or how do you choose children's books? That must be a bit different of a process than others.
A little bit. From a year after we first opened, we started doing school book fairs. So we were able to profit from the wisdom of teachers and what they recommended, and librarians. And so that was a really valuable aspect of learning about the children's book world. Of course, I had my own experience as a child and what I liked. I kind of have a criterion that kind of goes against the grain, and that I kind of am drawn to and focus on, well, I guess it's not so surprising, classic children's books. So I tend to be drawn to the older children's books, the ones that have not been formed by modern trends, perhaps modern prejudices and blindnesses. C.S. Lewis has a great essay called On the Reading of Old Books, and he says for every new book that you read, you should read two old ones. To quote, keep the fresh wind of the centuries blowing through our minds. And I take that really seriously, and even especially in the arena of children's books. I think that some of the older books have a depth and a richness that a lot of the more contemporary ones don't. so sometimes I fall into a pattern of older is better.
Okay.
Or instead of the newer a book is, the better or more interesting.
Yeah.
It's chronological snobbery in reverse. Again, C.S. Lewis talks about chronological snobbery as the kind of natural tendency to assume that we're always progressing and whatever is newer is going to be better. And I take kind of the opposite stance of, well, not so much. I find that I tend to favor the older over the newer. So that has its own pitfalls, but that's what we do.
Okay. So when you walk into the bookstore, the art forms are hard to ignore. Can you describe, just describe your art forms?
Well, those art forms would be overwhelmingly the iconographic tradition in the Eastern Christian world. It has roots in earliest Christianity, at least from the, well, you go back to the catacomb paintings and bas-relief sculptures, and then you have the development of formal sorts of canonical rules about the making of Christian art. The iconographic tradition is inseparable from the liturgy of the church. It's meant to be, again, an integral part of the experience of Christian worship. If you go back to the early centuries and the earliest Byzantine centuries. So we've had icons from the very beginning. I feel like they are another form of theology, visual theology. I like the fact that they're unsentimental, that they they're not trying to be realistic representations. There's a whole different set of presuppositions by which an iconographer creates his icon, his or her icons. And there's just a deeply rich tradition that icon making is rooted in. It's a celebration of the kingdom of God, which is in many ways beyond our experience of this world. And so instead of a realistic representation, you're drawn into a representation of life in the kingdom, transformed by life in the kingdom. So they've been around so much and they're so present in our store that you kind of begin to take them for granted, but I think to somebody coming in the store for the first time, they're probably shocked,
yeah,
in ways good or bad.
It's a representation that confronts you. I'm really big on Paul Ricoeur, so representation that confronts who you are as a person that makes you change, or makes you look at things differently.
That's a good summation.
Okay.
Yeah.
What property is owned by the bookstore? Is only this bookstore owned?
Yeah, this is the only.
Okay.
It's the only location we have, and we do own the building now. The first 13 years, we were in leased space in Clifton Square, just a half a mile east of where we are now. Part of the reason for moving was to move into a space that we could end up owning. Which thankfully we've been able to do that.
What do you see for the future of the
Well, at some point I would love to see a meeting space attached to the store where readings and book groups could be held more in more spacious quarters than we're able to provide here. Perhaps a coffee, a coffee house dimension to what we do now. That's a lack that I really mourn. So I'd like to see that develop going forward. I'm not sure how that would look right now, but we always have it in the back of our minds. There has been and will be no change in our primary criteria of book choice. If you looked at the categories that we stock today, they're by and large the same as when we first opened the front doors. Much more emphasis now, I think, on the arts, because in the past 25 years, I'd say, there's been a real explosion of religion and the arts activities and thoughts in the general culture. So we have a much larger representation of that. A lot of that is due to our experience with a great journal called Image, a journal of the arts and religion that was founded by Greg Wolf back in the late 80s. And we've had extremely close relationship with Greg's project and the journal itself, and a series of workshops that they sponsor every summer. This year will be, I think, our 22nd time going to that particular conference. So a lot of credit has to be paid to Image. Also, another exploding category would be classical Christian education. We do at least 3 or 4 different education conferences every year. And the classical education movement has really exploded in influence and numbers. So that's been another category that we probably had very little of when we first started, but now have an extensive inventory of books on classical education.
Question about the bookstore. Have there been any memorable figures that have visited your bookstore, or have you had any memorable events held by the bookstore through its history?
We have had some famous people come through here. Probably earliest on would have been T.F. Torrance, a prominent Reformed theologian from Scotland. In the world of Reformed theology, he's one of the top names of the 20th century, certainly. He was here in the first year or two that we were open. Another landmark was when Callistus Ware, who is a contemporary Orthodox theologian, probably the best known in the world, in the English-speaking world anyway, was here in February of 2002. He had come to Wichita for a series of retreats, and during that time, the hosts of these events brought him by the store. And so we treasure the photographs that were taken of him here in the store. We've had some pretty fine authors here. It would take too long to mention them all. Scott Cairns, one of the best contemporary American poets, has been here numerous times. Ralph Wood, who teaches theology and literature at Baylor University, has been there numerous times. Hans Boersma, contemporary theologian, many. And many of these theologians have been in Wichita because of the activity of Eighth Day Institute and the three central events that they have every year. The Eighth Day Symposium this year will be our ninth symposium, where we have speakers from the three great Christian traditions, Catholic, Orthodox, and Protestant, present a position paper, so to speak, representing their tradition concerning a particular designated theme. So the Eighth Day Institute has brought a lot of great thinkers and writers to the store. Yeah, so that's another whole part of the story, is the development of the Eighth Day Institute. I think I can go.
Well, that's my next question. That's my next question.
Okay.
And feel free to elaborate as well. Can you describe the history and mission of the Eighth Day Institute?
Yes, in brief, it is the creation of the vision, from the vision of a former employee of mine and good friend, Aaron Doom, who worked here from 1998 to 2006, and then struck out on his own while he was doing graduate studies in history and theology, to found the Eighth Day Institute, as it eventually became known. It was originally called the St. John of Damascus Institute, but for a number of reasons, the name was changed to reflect the relationship between Eighth Day Books and Eighth Day Institute. The Institute is, to be clear, the Institute is a nonprofit organization that exists to renew culture through faith and learning. That's the short form of a description of the Eighth Day Institute. You might even look at it like an educational arm of the bookstore. Beyond the education that's available just in the books themselves, Eighth Day Institute brings together like-minded people, or people who are interested in the renewal of small-o Orthodox Christianity, both in its Orthodox, Catholic, and Protestant forms. It's one of its purposes is to bring together in fellowship Nicene Christians, those Christians who unite around the Confession of Faith of Nicaea in 325 AD, which became the classic symbol of the Christian faith. The Institute sponsors, as I said before, the symposia. There is a bi-weekly gathering there called the Hall of Men, in which local men meet together to have a meal, to share a meal, some beer, and a lecture. This has been going on for about 10 years, twice a month. And in the future, we'll provide a digital library of all the writing, and both printed and spoken work that goes on in the Eighth Day Institute and in the symposia. There's many other visions of the Institute. Eighth Day Books has always tried to work hand in glove with the Institute, always trying to distinguish the two different entities, so people realize that we're a regular for-profit bookstore and the Eighth Day Institute is a regular non-profit organization that depends on donor support.
membership, or are there rules for membership, or is it just you're invited to come?
It's both.
How are people invited?
It's both. There's an open invitation for people to come to the activities of the Institute. And if they wish, if they have enough interest and want to go to a deeper level, then they can become members at several different levels with several different levels of benefit from the activities of the Institute. So it really tries to be both. The 8th Day Symposia, is attended by many people who are not members, but hopefully become members through a good experience with that event and others like it.
Okay. What are the demographics of people who attend, religious demographics? I mean, they're all... Obviously, the Hall on Men is men.
There's also a corresponding kind of fellowship of women called the Sisters of Sophia, and they do the same sort of thing that the Hall of Men does, only attended only by women. And then the public events, of course, are open to the whole world, men, women, children sometimes.
Do you have anything else to add regarding the Institute?
Well, the Institute was founded, I believe, in 2008. So it is past its 10th anniversary and is gaining in the articulation of its vision and on the number of members. One of our primary hopes this coming year is to bring back the 8th Day book catalog, which 8th Day Books put together and mailed from 1989 until 2012. So we like to say that the catalog didn't end in 2012, it just went into a pause. And so, in cooperation with the 8th Day Institute, 8th Day Books hopes to get that catalog back out into people's hands, which is a completely countercultural thing to publish a big fat catalog, mail order catalog of ink on paper, but it also expresses a real conviction that that's the best way to read. It remains the best way to read, despite the rise of digital reading and countless screens that we're surrounded by in this culture. We still believe that there's a devoted core of readers who want to read ink on paper.
What have been some of the topics that been discussed at the symposiums? Do you have themes? What are some popular topics that are discussed at the biweekly meetings?
Okay. So, as far as the symposia are concerned, our very first one was on classical education. And there was a talk called Why Books? Of course, that was in 2011, and that was during the heyday, the real surge of interest in digital reading, of the Kindle, devices. And it was popularly touted that this kind of reading would replace books. Well, that hasn't happened, and it just so happens that digital reading has plateaued and begun to decline as a percentage of all reading. So that was the first symposium. Others that followed were on the Inklings, the nature of the Fellowship of Writers that met in the circle of C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, Charles Williams, and so forth. There's a group of friends at Oxford in England who met twice a week, I think. And in these meetings, they read works in progress by each other. It was through the Inklings that Tolkien eventually published The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, because of the encouragement of other members of that fellowship. C.S. Lewis read aloud things like the Screwtape Letters, things like some of the Chronicles of Narnia. That circle of friends nourish those kinds of books that change the face of Christian thought and the arts. So there's enough material in the Inklings that you could have a conference every year. And as a matter of fact, we do have one of the yearly events that the Institute sponsors is an Inklings Festival, which focuses on one or the other of the great Inkling members. There was a symposium on Dostoevsky, focusing on Dostoevsky. Another year was focused on Eros and the family, the meaning of family and friendship. Well, in fact, one of the symposia was focused on friendship itself, versus often the isolating force of social media and of screens all around us. Yes, within arm's reach, two or three. So that gives you a sense of what the symposium focuses on. The Hall of Men is structured around a lecture on a great hero of the faith, be they Orthodox, Catholic, or Protestant, or be they just a great positive cultural force. So each week, someone prepares a talk on a great figure like this. This is after the attendees have had a nice meal and a couple of beers, perhaps, and then there's the lecture. So there's kind of a consistent attendance of 20 to 30 men at those events, likewise with the Sisters of Sophia. So that's the basic structure of these meetings. What was the other part of the question?
It wasn't a question. It was something I think you answered the thing. Just what are topics covered?
Right. So now after 10 years, twice a month, go figure, there's been a couple of hundred different topics, a couple of hundred different figures in Christian history who have been discussed. It's just a great well of learning and experience that opens up. Part of the purpose of the Institute itself is to bring together people from the great traditions and really experience what these traditions have to say. Not just secondhand, not just as a result of polemics, which can also can often be superficial, but you actually have to face fellow Christians of other traditions and see them as real people and hear what they have to say about Christian faith. Likewise, you say with all honesty and without covering up the blemishes your own faith. and the differences between you. But to be able to do that in a community of friendship, in a conviviality, but in honesty too, not trying to cover over the real differences that still exist between us as Christians.
Okay. You follow the kind of David Ford scriptural reasoning or Peter Oaks?
I'm not familiar. Well, I've heard their names.
It's kind of like interfaith dialogue, but you don't water it down.
Exactly.
You confront the differences and the interest in reconciling, or the interest in at least understanding one another, is enough for a camaraderie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what we call Eighth Day Ecumenism in the context of Eighth Day Institute. And actually, Eighth Day books. I mean, the bookstore here, we try to put the best resources of each of the great traditions on the table, side by side, so that you can look at them objectively and see the best statements of those traditions that exist. That's always been an aspiration of the bookstore. There is no place in the store for proselytizing. People are welcome to come here and go about their business and their interests without any interference from staff. No attempt to proselytize. But if questions are asked, we say what we can to answer them and be honest about our own faith. So that's been at the ground of Eighth Day Books since the beginning, and that's also an essential guiding principle in the Eighth Day Institute.
Employees here all Orthodox?
No. We have, well, right now we have a couple of Catholics and we have three Orthodox. That's what it consists of right now, but we've had plenty of Protestants of various stripes and a couple who weren't committed to a faith but are open to learning. There's always been a diverse crowd around here, and our clientele also reflects a real diversity of Christian experience, and many non-Christians come here just because of the what we feel like is the richness of what's offered on the shelves. We have a lot of people come in who aren't believers at all, but appreciate the quality of the books.
Into the personal place. Perhaps you can cut this thing.
But if I'm asked.
Yes. But if you're asked.
But if I'm asked, I share my understanding of what Orthodoxy is as the best that I can. In the midst of that, I try to maintain an attitude of respect for those of other traditions. Because that's the only way you can go forward is with respect. Respect and honesty. Those two things in tandem, I think, lead us forward in a profitable way towards fullness of truth. Hopefully that's what we're all aiming for. Personally and communally, we want to embrace the fullness of truth. I believe that fullness is best expressed in the Orthodox faith. and others that come in here feel it's best expressed in the Roman Catholic faith. We all, we're honest with each other that we're close friends. It's the way it's always been.
So what is the name of your church?
St. George Orthodox Christian Cathedral.
And where is it located?
It's close to 13th and Rock Road.
What would be the defining characteristics of the Orthodox faith in your opinion? What sets it apart from Catholicism and Protestantism? You can go way back in history.
So, Orthodoxy is the fullness of Christian experience. To define it simply, I think I could start with that. It is the community that flows from the experience of beholding the risen Christ. Therefore, it goes back to the very pristine origin of Christian faith. It starts at the empty tomb, and it has come down as a stream of Christian experience down through the centuries in an unbroken sort of manner. So when you look at the church, you're looking at the present expression of that fullness of tradition that is absolutely continuous with the community of believers that witness the empty tomb and the risen Christ. So there's never been a break in it. There's just been this growing apprehension of truth and of experience that primarily exists in the liturgy, as we discussed earlier, and the living experience of the saints down through history in all ages, in their infinite variety, they all seem to speak with one voice when it comes to the expression of Christian faith. Whether they were sophisticated theologians like many of the church fathers, or whether they were unlettered peasants, rough peasants like St. Silouan of Mount Athos, just the last century, and many others, they all speak with one voice. They all witness to the same experience of God, the Holy Trinity, and the ongoing historical consequences of God's incarnation in Jesus Christ. These are the touchstones of Orthodox faith since the very beginning, and that the Church maintains through its confession of the Nicene Creed every time we celebrate the liturgy.
Have you participated in any other religious organization?
Yes, as I mentioned before, when I was a teenager, I became deeply involved in an evangelical arena of young Jesus people. An enthusiastic sort of experience of basic Christianity with some charismatic sort of touches to it, I guess you could say. I found it overwhelmingly a positive experience. I feel like that it did not contradict Orthodoxy, but it simply enhanced my experience of God in Jesus Christ. As far as calling it an organization, that's the last thing you would call it, because it was deeply unorganized. But the central aspects of it were fellowship in small groups and in Bible studies, and in evangelism in various ways. In study groups, that was one of the central. That's as close as you got to organized in those days. But no, apart from that, unorganized organization. I've always been in the church. I've never left the church, even during my Jesus freak days. Never been involved in any other religious organization.
Why do you think people are attracted to broadly Orthodox faith, but more specifically St. George Orthodox Cathedral that you're a member of?
I think people are drawn because of a thirst, sometimes unrecognized thirst, for a deeper expression of Christian faith, one that has historical roots that go back to the very earliest generations. I mean, every day I see it in the publishing world. I mean, even your most well-known evangelical and reformed publishers are using iconography to decorate their new publications. Yes. Okay. We've got a couple hours before we have to get it. So I'm still up here with Jacob. Okay. Okay, good. The attraction.
Yes. And Protestant publishers using iconography.
Yeah, that's just one.
Or evangelical.
I think that's just one manifestation of a real desire to express a deeply historical sense of Christian tradition. And so those iconographic front covers on evangelical books, I think, are an unspoken or an inarticulated sort of expression of that thirst. Why else? I mean, it's just obvious. They're just all over the place. There's an interest in icons by all manner of Christians and non-Christians even. Why is that? I think it's an authentic, unsentimental experience of Christian art, if you want to put it that way. Although icons are not just art. In fact, to consider them as just art is to contradict the very meaning of them. Interest in the church fathers. I think it's in the church fathers that Christians of all ages find their commonality, because the church fathers expressed the faith when Christendom was all still unified in a fundamental way. So if all Christians have something in common, it's the fathers. And whether many traditions within Protestantism don't recognize that, it is the fact. I mean, the basic doctrines of the faith were hammered out in the age of the fathers. They took the biblical data and they synthesized it with Greco-Hellenistic thought, and that is what the basic Christian faith is. It's that synthesis. And it's, you know, Protestants have to own up to that, you know. So
again, I've probably gone off the course of what you asked.
Okay.
So again, in the publishing world, there are a number of books that have been published in the last 15, 20 years, getting to know the Church Fathers. Why is there this interest in the Church Fathers? I think it expresses, again, a thirst for the authentic, a thirst for the historic versus the ephemeral, you know, that you see come and go, trends that come and go every few years. And looking back 15 years later, those trends are almost look bizarre.
Yes.
So I see that in my experience as a bookseller, just limiting it to books.
Last question. How are members, what is the joining process in the Orthodox Church? Is it defined by baptism? Is it defined by a catechism? Is it for an adult and for an infant or for a child? What would be the, how would someone join the Orthodox Church?
Well, the experience of the Orthodox is that a person, well, since the 4th century, certainly, but even earlier, a person was part of the Church as infants, as children. They were baptized into the faith and raised in a manner that would, in which the baptismal grace that they had been given was unfolded through the course of their lives and their experience of the Church. That's been the overwhelming experience of most Christians since the 4th century, I guess you could say. But obviously in the earlier centuries, adult formation was the rule. And
more comforts.
Yeah. Right, right. And so, in the early church, people went through a very rigorous process of catechesis, of teaching, of learning the Christian faith, usually lasting 2 or 3 years. And then they were brought to baptism, usually on the night of Easter, and experience their baptism and their first Eucharist. Orthodox churches in the modern world, they all, I would say that they all have a catechetical program of some sort or another. Hopefully it mirrors the process in the early church of a pretty strict and rigorous catechetical program of requiring the catechumen to live through a Christian year, at least one Christian year, going through a Lent, for instance. And with the experience of that Christian year and formal teaching, a person is brought into the faith. Often in the modern Orthodox world, it's through chrismation, that is, anointing with holy oil, and a confession of faith in the Orthodox Church, because, at least in the Antiochian family of churches and in the OCA family of churches, the baptism of other Christian traditions is accepted as valid if a person is baptized in the name of the Holy Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, not Creator, Sustainer, Redeemer, anything, any other UFO equivalent. It has to be in the name of the Trinity, and it has to be by baptism in water. And so in most instances, those baptisms are considered valid, and chrismation is seen as the completion or the fulfillment of those baptisms. So that's the situation in the contemporary Orthodox world, at least as far as I've experienced here in Wichita. Now, there are many variations in different parts of the Orthodox world, and it would take too long to go into those variations.
As are, there's so many variations.
Yes.
Everything else.
Yes.
Okay. Just wrapping this up, is there anything you want to add about the bookstore, about the Institute, about yourself, that you don't believe has been covered or that I've asked?
No, I think that covers it.
All right. Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jake.